And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender community. This is Queer Voices.
And I'm Jennifer Renee.
And Brian Levinka.
Summer Iman.
And Glenn Holt. And on tonight's show, we are doing something a little bit different. We are going to repeat J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage from last week, because we were not on the air in Houston last week. You may have heard by now that KPFT was taken off the air Sunday night a week ago by copper thieves who stole the power lines running to the transmitter. In our second hour this evening, Queer Music Heritage is the music of Harvey Milk. Before that, This Way Out presents a rare interview with Harvey Milk, who was the first openly gay person elected to public office in California as San Francisco's supervisor. It's an exclusive, intimate half hour with the legendary gay activist, recorded shortly after Milk took office in March 1978, 8 months before he was assassinated. But first, we have David Elliott from Washington, D.C., and a look at the latest developments in GLBT politics from the nation's capital, and then GLBT Pride in the Park, this coming Saturday the 10th, and it's the Astros versus the St. Louis Cardinals.
Yes, play ball!
There you go.
So we are maybe play ball.
So we going to have...
Shirley Temple.
Yeah, we going to have some our kind in the park.
The gays in the park.
That's right.
I like that. That's terrific stuff.
You know, it's something different, and we can go
don't
out...
Don't forget to wear your pink or lavender.
I'm sure there'll be quite a array of attire and costumes and baseball get-ups for the evening.
Is David Elliott with us?
We're just checking to see. We have a phone. Somebody phoned in, so we're checking to see if it's David.
Oh, well, I hope it is. If not, we'll just sit there and talk.
I think it is. David, is that you?
Well, this is me.
Hey.
David, welcome. This is Jennifer Renee.
And Brian Levinka.
How are you tonight?
We've got a... Who do we have? We have Jennifer. We've got...
Brian and Glenn. We're
Brian
all here.
Yes. And Glenn and Jack, right?
No, Jack's not here tonight. Jack's taking a couple of weeks off.
And Summer is here.
Okay.
And Summer is here. We're all here. The four of us are here. And we want to hear what you've got to say tonight.
Well, you know, I have to start out with an apology.
Okay. You're forgiven.
Thanks. I actually am a little bit injured. I usually call in the first Monday of every month and give a political update.
Yes.
And I had actually emailed Jack, but I guess that he's not like around because he probably didn't get the email. I have a severe injury to my right wrist that I've had for the last couple of weeks, so I haven't really been able to, prepare like I usually do. So I'm going to have to wing it. So
well,
y'all are going to have to bear with me if that's okay.
Well, that we do interviews all the time just like that. So we'll just have a relaxed conversation. I mean, it's just the 3, 4, 5 of us sitting around having a cup of coffee talking about politics. So what's going on in Washington right now?
Well, you know, I want to talk about 2 or 3 or 4 things right now, because there's a lot of strange stuff going on, okay?
Well, start off with the strangest.
Okay, let's talk about the number one issue facing America right now, jobs.
Absolutely.
Since December 2007, that would be 2.5 years, we have lost 8 million jobs in this country, and a lot of people are really, really hurting. And last week, Congress did something that was incredibly, incredibly, how can I say this? Disgusting, distasteful, unethical. I don't even know where to go.
Insensitive comes to mind.
Well, because of the Senate's inaction. Within the last week, 1.2 million Americans have lost their unemployment benefits. Another 400,000 have lost their COBRA health care subsidies. And you might say, well, okay, so it's a big deal. Everybody's hurting. But come on, what we're looking at now, is hundreds of thousands of jobs being lost on the state level, including in Texas, across the country, because of Congress's failure to act. Why is Congress failing to act?
Yeah, because, tell me that. I want to know, because I have heard the news, I read the news, I watch TV and get the news. I don't understand their logic in this.
Well, I'm going to spell it out for you.
Please.
I'm going to spell it out for you. Republicans and some Democrats are worried about the federal deficit. But I'm going to tell you something about the deficit. We do have a large federal deficit. Why do we have a large federal deficit? Four reasons. First, because the Bush 2001-2003 tax cuts. Second, because we decided to go to war in Iraq and not pay for it, and then again in Afghanistan to a lesser extent. Third, because of spiraling health care costs. And fourth, we have a huge federal deficit because of the current recession, i.e., duh, when people are out of work, that means they're not paying jobs. I mean, that means that they're not paying taxes. That means people, you know, local, state, and federal governments aren't collecting tax revenue.
Now, part of
deficit.
That, yeah, and part of that, too, is this deficit that during the Bush years, the war was off the books. They didn't even show it in the budget itself. And President Obama said that in his budgets, he would show it as a budget item, which suddenly throws us into these enormous budget deficits. But we had those all along. They just weren't shown.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And everybody says, and I heard it, you know, over this holiday weekend. I was with some of my friends, you know, doing a 4th of July barbecue, and they were saying, oh, Obama, he's doing all the spending. And I was like, wait just a minute. He actually is not doing hardly any spending at all compared to what Bush did. So, yeah, that's the big problem. So that's story number one, okay? You know, the deficit and the failure of Congress to, you know, do anything to extend unemployment insurance, you know, help people who are hurting. Now, another weird story that I want to bring up right now is, has anybody noticed the Supreme Court confirmation hearings that are going on?
Well, really not since she got out from in front of the committee. It sort of went off the radar for a while.
Well, is this not, correct me if I'm wrong here, is this not the most boring Supreme Court nomination fight that we have seen in modern history?
Well, except when they have a few of those wackadoodle witnesses that come up and say some rather bizarre things.
Yeah, right. So, where are we going forward? We're in a really, really, really bizarre place. And let me explain what I mean by that.
Okay, please.
We are looking at electoral Armageddon come November. It looks like Republicans could pick up 50 seats in the House of Representatives and very easily take over the House. Now, the weird thing about that is they're going to do that while blaming the Democrats for the poor economy and while blaming Obama for not putting people back to work, when, in fact, it's been the Republicans all along that's been supporting policies that created the poor economy and opposing policies to put people back to work.
The big lie.
How bizarre is that?
It's the big lie. You tell a lie long enough, somebody's going to believe it.
Yeah, we're looking at, you know, Alice down the looking glass. I don't know if I said that right, but it's really very bizarre.
How are they getting away with the big lie? I mean, you know, they keep there are those individuals out there who call, you have a name similar to a beverage, a hot beverage, and they start talking about comparing Obama to Hitler and stuff like that. But what they do is what Goebbels did, you know, keep telling that lie long enough and almost anybody will start believing it. And that's what they've done. They, meaning the individuals perpetrating the lie.
Yeah, well, I might not go exactly where you just went, you know, with the Nazi references, but I see where you're going. Let me take you in another direction, if I may.
Okay, please.
We recently had, and when I say we, I work for a group called U.S. Action, and we had a Sam Greenberg, a prominent pollster, come and talk to our board of directors. And he came and talked to us about, you know, where the electorate is right now. And the fact is, up until the last year or two, the American public has never really, really cared, according to polling data, about the federal deficit. Right?
Right. Okay.
So why all of a sudden are they caring about the federal deficit? Well, they're caring about it because they think that all of the bailouts, starting with the bank bailouts that happened before Obama was elected, you know, when AIG was bailed out, and, you know, the huge too big to fail stuff, all that happened. And then, you know, when Obama took office and, you know, we had to bail out the big automobile dealers and we had to do the stimulus bill, they are converging all of that with the federal deficit and thinking that those are the causes of the federal deficit, like the stimulus bill or the automobile bailout. They're not understanding, according to the polling data that we're looking at, that it was because of the Iraq war.
The $1.3 trillion we spent off the books.
Yeah, exactly.
For a war.
Yeah, and they're not understanding that it was because of the 2001 and 2003 Bush tax cuts. They're thinking it's the recent stuff, which all totaled amounts to $1.6 trillion, when the Bush stuff actually adds up to about $8 trillion.
But the word's not getting out.
No.
So what does the electric think about all of this? What are they going to do? Are they just going to sit at home, or they're energized to go out and vote in November to vote the rascals out?
It's too early to say. You know, we're looking at the first week of July. You know, we've got August coming up. I will say this. It matters who votes. It matters who votes. Are young people going to vote? Are single women going to vote? Is the LGBT community going to vote? Are African Americans going to vote? Is labor going to vote? Is everybody going to just sit at home and have older, angry white guys vote? You know, are they the ones who are going to vote? That's what kind of makes the difference. I mean, that's what's going to, you know, turn the tide in November.
Well, what else is crazy going on or wackadoodle going on that you want to talk about?
You know, that's a good question. I'm sitting here with an extremely injured right wrist and trying to hold my cell phone up to my ear. And I'm sorry, the sound's not too great with my left ear.
No, you sound fine.
What else is going on?
Well, you had said you started off with there were four things going on, and I was wondering, make sure we didn't miss any of them.
Well, you know, we've overlooked the greatest environmental disaster of our lifetime.
Oh yes, and it's still going on, and it will. You know, it. They're saying it'll be if those relief wells actually do relieve it, it'll be done by the end of this month. But no one's talking about the fact if it doesn't work.
Well, and, you know, I just was looking at some of the news highlights a couple of minutes ago. And, you know, we have a possible tropical storm heading into the Gulf of Mexico again.
Oh, yes. And it's on a different track than the last one.
Well, yeah, who knows where it's going to go. It's early, but yeah. But yeah, so, and we've got a hugely interesting governor's race in Texas.
Oh, absolutely. The last poll I saw said they're virtually tied.
Tied up, yeah.
And who knows if that poll is good or not, but everybody up in D.C. is looking at it, and it's really, really interesting.
Is that going to cause money to come into the state from other states? Because this looks like a possibility for a win here in Texas.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
What are they saying elsewhere in the country about our race?
They're saying that it's one of the few possibilities for a Democratic pickup because over and over and over again, in state after state after state, in other states, we're going to lose. It's a counterintuitive thing that's happening in Texas.
Well, we've been under the oppression of Perry for quite some time.
The Perry regime.
Right. Yes, you know. There's the Perry regime.
Peronista.
Right.
Yes. The Peronistas have been in charge. We've been wanting help from the United States.
Right.
So what is it you do for your day job?
Well, for my day job, I work for a group called USAction.org. We spent the last couple of years working to pass health care reform. Now we're trying to get jobs legislation through Congress and an extension on unemployment insurance and COBRA and FMAP, you know, relief to the states.
Right.
You can check us out at usaction.org. You can see our blog at www.truemajority.org/aggressive-progressive.
Thank you so much. We, as always, this is the first of the month. We talk with David Elliott in Washington, D.C. about the latest in political events going on in Washington, D.C. Thank you again for being on the show tonight. even though you are wounded in action?
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I'm sorry that I am a bit wounded. I couldn't write anything in advance. I've got one limb missing. But hopefully a month from now, I'll be back 100%.
Absolutely. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
This is Queer Voices.
One love without condition, just one love without permission, just one love like rainfall, just one love to erase them all, just one love who knows my face, just one love that knows no race, just one love can end all the hate. Can I get one love?
Jeremy Henry, Just One Love, from his single released this year. This is Queer Voices.
And if you have not already heard about this coming Saturday...
What's happening Saturday?
It is the first annual Pride in the Park LGBT
Pride. The first time in history.
First time in Houston. I don't know if they've had that before, but we have...
No, a history of Houston. I mean, Houston is the world.
That's all that matters. Okay. This is Brian Levinka.
And Jennifer Renee.
And in the studio, we have the chairs of the event, Trevor and Edward. Say
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, guys.
How are y'all?
Now, how are you connected to the event?
Well, it's a great story that the Astros contacted me earlier this year. They had seen the My Gay Houston campaign that the Convention and Visitors Bureau started, and we got a phone call from the Houston Astros saying, wow, this is great that the city's now got a website that the Convention Visitors Bureau is promoting, and we might want to do a game just and to dedicate the game to Houston's LGBT community.
I think it's great that they discovered there are gays in Houston.
The Astros called the gays, and they said, we want to do a game.
Yeah. But isn't that cool?
They called the British gay, even.
Wow.
Now, Edward, how are you connected to that?
Well, actually, Trevor gave me a phone call. I do a lot of fundraising in the community, and I've had a lot of experience about putting a wonderful events together to raise money for different organizations. And he had asked me, he goes, do you think this is possible? I said, are you kidding? This is going to be amazing. We got to do something just absolutely phenomenal for this. And it's been a lot of hard work, and it's been a lot of wonderful times together, but it's finally happening this Saturday. I'm very excited about it.
Now, we can't mention the ticket price on the air, but they are very in different, they're affordable, and there's different levels, like
correct,
a normal Astros game. And where can they find out information about the tickets before we get into the event, just so people are out there listening and know what to
there is a website that the Astros have created for us, and it's simply astros.com/pride. And then there's a keyword that you type in there, and it is the word pride, and then you can choose then from the different options to get your tickets.
Okay, so let's talk about Saturday and what to expect. I know there's a lot of things planned, a lot of bells and whistles and all kinds of cool things going on, so let's talk about that.
Well, I know that the game starts at 6:05. You know, I love the Astros, but I'm not, I don't go to every single game. So they tell me the game starts at 6:05. So if we want to see all the fun stuff that starts before then, like Mayor and East Parker throwing out the first pitch.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Yay.
We love our mayor.
We do. And so she'll be doing that probably 30 minutes to 40 minutes before the actual game actually starts. So if you want to actually catch a glimpse of that, you need to get there rather early.
About 5-ish.
I would say even earlier than that. I'd say like 4:30.
Ooh, that's
well, you know, we gays like to socialize.
Yeah,
so we
get there early. I mean, what if you're going to be there on a Saturday afternoon, go in and get there early enough to enjoy being there.
Well, exactly.
I mean, this is a bit of history we're having.
This is history.
If you go VIP... If you go VIP, there's a party that starts at 4 o'clock.
Oh.
So that's a really...
Now, let's talk about the money. This is a fundraiser. This
yes,
is,
it
we're
is.
Raising money for community organizations. Which organizations are we raising money?
We have 7 organizations that are going to benefit from this event. And it was a large, lengthy process that we went through to identify these 7 organizations. And it was done through a voting process. It was a blind voting activity that Edward, myself, and members of the Astros participated in. And it came down to the following 7 groups. And it's in no particular order. It's PFLAG, Bearing Omega Community Services, Out and Equal Houston, Pride Houston, the Bayou City Performing Arts, Legacy Community Health Services, and Bunnies on the Bayou.
Yay. Absolutely. Great group of people.
It's a very diverse group, and it kind of represents many portions of our community. So
that was a huge goal of this activity, and the Astros were fully supportive of this being a very diverse event and to celebrate equality. And one of the other great things that's about to come out of this that we just found out, and we just kind of announced this today on Facebook, as well as Mayor Nice Parker throwing out the opening pitch, yay. There is a city proclamation coming on Saturday. Saturday will be officially known as Pride in the Park Day in
yay.
Houston.
Absolutely. Oh, good. Good, so, good, good.
And I understand that we're having someone sing the national anthem.
We are. The Bayou City Performing Arts are going to be singing the national anthem. They're bringing, I believe, about 100 to 120 of their artists and performers to come and sing the national anthem along with the winner of Pride Idol.
Well,
going to be that.
How about that? Awesome.
Now, let's talk about ticket sales. Are we close to selling out? Do we need our listeners to get on the phone lines and start selling? We need to fill the ballpark.
That's exactly what we need to do. This is our first showing, so we want to look good coming out of the gate. So we want to make sure that everybody actually buys tickets and recommends their tickets to other people as well. So we've got several tickets sold, several hundred tickets sold now, but we need so many more.
Several hundred you know, several thousand.
Well, that's what we'd like to hear.
Thousands would be wonderful.
Several thousands.
Well, you know, thousands.
The stadium seats 40,000. So, listeners of Queer Voices, we need you to come out and be queer.
All 40,000 of you who listen.
We should. We have enough gays in this city. We should fill this park. Yeah, I mean, really, it's a good time for a good cause.
Let's prove how many of us there really are by filling the stadium.
That's a great idea.
I challenge all of you.
I had a question. If there, we have a listener out there that wants to buy a ticket, how will they be assigned seats? Is that something that they'll find online and they can sit with their friends? Or will they be near other gays?
It's a really great question. Because of the massive amounts of logistics that are involved at Minute Maid Park, we were only able to secure one group seating area, which is the VIP area. If you do want to go and sit in other areas with other groups, call some of these organizations, because I know that Out and Equal have assigned a group area.
Bunnies on the Bayou.
The Bunnies have. Mm-hmm. The Bayou City Performing Arts, they have. I believe Legacy have. So there are different groups are making their own arrangements. We chose to do the different pricing options this time just because we... First time for us doing this, so we didn't really know what the right pricing point was going to be, so we wanted to be inclusive for everybody, not just one particular price point. So our recommendation to you, if you have a group of more than 20 people that you want to bring, and you can call the Astros directly, you can call...
What's that number?
It is, that number is 713-259-8314.
And that's for groups of 20 or more?
20 or more.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk to, there's a rep on site at the Astros that's dedicated to us. Now, just to take care of.
Let's give that number one more time. I have 713-529.
It's 259.
Okay, well, let's...
Ooh, I know, we had
a little
printing faux pas.
Okay, let's one more time.
713-259-8314.
Okay, great. And that's to get group tickets.
Now, for me, I just really found out about this weekend because I hit a couple of emails came through, you know, Pride in the Park, and at first I didn't realize what it was. So are we just getting the word out late, or what happened? Talk to me.
No, actually, when we first were approached with this, Trevor and I actually did a Facebook campaign to see how many people would actually be interested in actually doing something like this, and it went viral. I mean, I think we got close to 1,000 people in within a 7-day period saying, yes, they would definitely love to attend. So with that in mind, you know, we went ahead and went forward and started planning and started doing the things that we need to do to ensure that this was going to happen. So,
and well, this started in February.
Yes. Oh,
yeah. Okay. They've been doing it for a long. I've been hearing about it for a long time.
Where was I? Under a rock?
No, it was on Facebook. A lot of Facebook promotion.
Are you on Facebook?
Yes, I am.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes,
well, let's
am.
Give our listeners that Facebook. It's just Pride in the Park.
Yeah, if they do a search for Pride in the Park, and you can look at the events right there, you'll be able to see, I think, gosh, there's 1,300 confirmed attending.
Yeah. Well, we need to double that. Come on.
Yeah, we do.
Well, that's a really, really interesting point, is that I got one of the editors from Outsports magazine called me a few weeks ago, and he was telling me, he said, look, he says, even if you get 400 to 500 people to turn up, Houston will have probably one of the largest LGBT events ever at a Major League Baseball game.
Well, let's do it.
Let's do it. Houston. Houston's great. We have a great GLBT community. Let's go out and see the game.
Okay, yes. So let's recap for our listeners. It's this Saturday.
Baseball game, Astros, and... Does anybody know who they're playing? Oh,
Cardinals.
Who cares?
It's the Cardinals.
They're playing the Cardinals.
That's
Cardinals.
Our big rival team.
Okay.
Yes.
So it's a bobblehead day, actually.
Oh.
If you get there early enough, you get a bobblehead.
Oh, yes. I think it's like first 10,000 okay. gets up. I don't know what a bobblehead is, but apparently you get a bobblehead.
It's an American thing, and it's crazy. the website for people is... What is that?
www.astros.com/pride. That's where they find all that information.
All the information and tickets. Well, we have to go, but I thank you for coming in. And I want you listeners to join us at the ballpark on Saturday. It's going to be fun. We're going to be queer, and we're going to have fun in the stadium.
Yay!
And this is Queer Voices.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
The gay establishment doesn't understand what the gay movement's all about. Get rid of them. And I'm not telling them they're not nice guys. Not nice, wonderful people. I'm not talking that they're fun people to be with. But if they don't understand what the gay movement's about, you got to get rid of them. And I'll tell you what the gay movement's about.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. On this special broadcast, we are proud to present in its entirety a rare interview with assassinated San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk. An exclusive, intimate half hour with the legendary gay activist, because you've discovered This Way Out. It was March of 1978, and a gay volunteer reporter at a Los Angeles community radio station took a trip to interview newly elected San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk. Their conversation covered civil rights activism, coalition politics, and Milk's own assessment of some of the gay power brokers of the day. Milk was assassinated 8 months later. The reporter was Greg Gordon, who went on to become This Way Out's coordinating producer. Gay director Gus Van Sant's 2008 film generated renewed interest in Milk's story, fueled by Sean Penn's Oscar-winning portrayal. Moviegoers found out, just like you're about to, that much of what Harvey had to say continues to resonate.
See the way he walks down the street.
I'm a supervisor in San Francisco.
And I'm Greg Gordon for IMRU.
I'm gay.
And so am I. And we're up in San Francisco in Harvey's office at Castro Camera. And Harvey has graciously taken a few minutes out of his very busy schedule to talk to us about politics in San Francisco and how he got elected, the first openly gay person to be elected to public office in California history.
I'd like to also talk about politics in California rather than San Francisco.
That's fine.
Because I don't think there's a delineation.
You don't think that there's a difference in politics in San Francisco as opposed to, let's say, politics in Los Angeles?
It's a matter of degree. There's no moat built around the city of San Francisco that separates us from the rest. Sometimes we wish there were. but I think what takes place in San Francisco, for whatever reasons, can take place any place. It's just a matter of understanding what it's all about. And San Francisco, it's very interesting because of the fact that I'm gay, that becomes the big media event that sells the newspapers. But it's very important that we realize that I was elected as a candidate who was gay rather than a gay candidate. Did that run on a gay issue? In San Francisco, the difference from L.A. is that we are both county supervisors and city council people, one and the same. The city is divided into 11 districts, and since we are city and county, it's one powerful, very powerful legislative group. You have to picture if your L.A. city council and your L.A. board of supervisors were one and the same. That's what we are. And we are an activist group rather than puppets of the strong mayor or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Or a strong police chief.
Or a strong police chief. We are very, very strong in this city. In the 11 districts that were up for election this past year, there were a total of something like 162 candidates altogether. Of the 162 candidates, there were 11, not even 11, there were about 7 or 8 who were incumbents who ran. 6, I guess. And X-ing those out, because they have a record of voting on issues. Of all the other 150-some-odd people, I was probably the most issue-oriented person running. Probably had taken more strong definitive stands, not yes, I'm for that, no, I'm not for that, but why, and been in the battles than all the other candidates running. Probably more issue-oriented than some of the supervisors who ran for re-election. At least I'm more... And it's vital to know that it took 4 years, or 5 years, or whatever it was, to build up that kind of a reputation.
Because you had run for office in the past.
It had nothing to do with running for office. It was the reason I ran for office because I was issue-oriented. You know, people say, oh, you ran for office, name recognition. No. In my particular district, we've had about 5 or 6 major district battles versus citywide problems. In every one, I was involved in them, on one side or the other. There wasn't one other candidate. There were 17 people running in this district. There wasn't one other candidate who had been involved in every single district problem. I was there. People on the streets would say to me, Harvey, I don't agree with your issue, but I know you're a fighter. I know you're there. I know you will be there when we need you. Let me give you a classic case that's going to be controversial right now. We have a statewide primary coming up, Attorney General. One of the people running for statewide in the Democratic primary is Yvonne Burke.
Mm-hmm.
My heart goes there. She's black. And she's a woman. Wham! There I go. But going in Orange County at the Democratic statewide meeting a couple months ago, where they all spoke, Orange County conservative. Orange County. Most of the people there. In fact, I was the only elected official outside of the L.A. Orange County area. So you had basically the conservative wing of the Democratic Party. Yvonne Burke got up and talked about the black people. Talked about women. Great. She sat down. Bert Pines got up and talked about battered wives, what he's done for them, the Latinos, what he's done for them, the blacks, what he's done for them, abused children, what he's done for them, and the gay community, what he's done for them. 3 times in his speech he talked about what he's done for the gay people in front of a very conservative audience. 3 months later, after the campaign trail, and these people have heard each other back and forth, in Sacramento, before the Democratic Minority Coalition, which is the traditional minorities, the feminists, and the gay people, they're speaking, knowing who the audience is speaking to. This is now not the conservative wing of the Democratic Party, but the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. They get up, Yvonne gets up and talks about the black issue, about women, sits down, Burke gets up and talks about the same thing. That's the difference. He's done his work. He's paid his dues. He's mm-hmm. willing to talk about it. He's an activist. He was involved doing things. She will vote right, but he's been there. A lot of candidates I ran against would vote right, the same as I do. But they wouldn't be the activist. They wouldn't be the advocate. They wouldn't be the leader.
I think that's what people are looking for these days, is somebody who will, you know, that's what we're crying out for, up even to the federal government.
Okay,
you know.
Statewide, let's get together statewide. May 5th, I think it's May 5th or May 6th, Sunday. May 6th, I guess it is. Sunday, L.A., we're calling together a statewide caucus of gay people. Convention, blah, blah, but not endorsement. And we're inviting all the candidates for statewide office, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, and I guess secretary of state.
It's nonpartisan?
Nonpartisan. Democrat, Republican, Peace and Freedom, American Independent. We want gay people from all over the state to come. With sending the letters to these people, we would have this caucus. We're going to say that you have 10, 15 minutes to present your case, and then questioning. But we don't want to hear about dams. We don't want to hear about redwood trees. We want to hear about what you think on the gay issues. What you think about that. And then we'll accept questions from the audience, filter them through a panel of gay newspaper people so that someone doesn't get up and do a 10-minute tirade. Right?
Yeah.
Like I do. And they'll be asked questions. If Jerry Brown does not show up, that will be published. If he shows up, what he says will be published. There'll be no endorsements. But we will disseminate the information.
It's a forum, basically.
It's a forum. It's like the black community. We must follow what the black community does. Black community does this on a national level. All the candidates for Democratic primary for president met before the black leadership forum, or whatever it was called, in North Carolina, and talked about black issues. We must do the same thing in the gay community. We must move out of San Francisco, out of L.A., we must move to California. If you add the gay community with the other traditional minorities, we should have control of the state. But we cannot sit in the back of the bus and let the other minorities lead. We should show the leadership. In fact, we're in an incredible position. You see...
Well, let me ask you, are other minorities coming around to realizing that they can and should work with the gay community?
Oh, yeah. Lieutenant Governor Dimley has stuck his neck out for the gay community over and over again. When Willie Brown's sexual bill was before the thing, he flew in from Denver to cast that vote in front of the eyes of the world. So he stuck his neck out there, and he understands working together. He understands the importance of gay people in there. But it's very interesting. Take San Francisco, which is a very heavy minority city. Over 50% of the population is minority. Because of the fighting for those crumbs, sometimes the black community doesn't talk to the Filipino, won't talk to the Asians won't talk to anybody, you know. Nevertheless, they all talk to me, the gay person. partly for two reasons. One, because within the gay community, we have gay Asians, gay blacks, gay, you know, we are infiltrated. That's part of the reason. We cut across the line. Second of all, for whatever reasons, I'm the one that can pull it together. So we are trying strongly to pull together that coalition. In view of that, we realized, at least I have always realized, is the voter registration. We are kicking off a massive voter registration drive with the Chinese and gay community together soon. You know, there's many reasons for that. Working very tight with the Asian community, very tight. And if we can pull it off here, and if LA pulls it off, if we pull it off statewide, that within 10 years, the minorities will be running the state. And when the minorities, I'm talking about the feminists, I'm talking about the gays, including on that. And so we have to fight that. We have to fight with our natural allies. But it can't be just because a person is black or green or gay or orange or whatever it may be. They have to be issue-oriented. Cannot accept somebody to get up there. I'm gay, therefore vote for me.
How do you motivate people to register? Because this is a fundamental problem that we've always had.
Motivate them, say, do you like Ed Davis? Do you like Senator Briggs? Do you like Leader Bryan? You motivate them because it's, you tell them that the legislators and the executive officers, be they the local supervisor, be they statewide, run your life. They run your life and they spend your money. When they collect tax money from gay people and don't give us anything back in return, take it for their golf courses, take our tax money for their pet projects, and give us, and on top of it, insult us by not giving us our rights. That's not motivation. If you like being harassed by the police, if you like being a third-class citizen, if you like being beat up by punks, if you like the church yelling at you, don't register, don't vote, but don't complain. If you want to be shoved back in your closet, if you want to be the traditional gay person who gets beat up and whimpers home and say, well, I'm gay and I deserve to get beat up, fine. Otherwise, the only thing you can do is register to vote.
What about the reasonably well-off gay couples or gay singles in the hills somewhere who never have had any trouble with the police, who've never, you know, they can say, that's never happened to me.
Right.
You know, why should I get involved? My life is beautiful.
Right. I.e., that reminds me of the wealthy Jews in Nazi Germany when Hitler first was picking up the Jewish communists and Jewish socialism. They were scum. That's not us. We are accepted. You know, we've been accepted. We ride in the back of the bus. It's like the Uncle Tom.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, when Hitler started having the concentration camp, he didn't care if you were a Jewish socialist or a Jewish fascist. If you were Jewish, you went. When the Briggs and Anita Bryan take over, they don't care if you are the accepted hairdresser or the gay doctor or the gay lawyer or the gay society person. You are gay, you will go off. And if that sounds like a stereotype thing, stop and think Nazi Germany, what it did to the gay people. There were 600,000 gay people killed. Prior to Hitler's taking over in the 20s, the gay movement in Germany was more advanced than the gay movement in San Francisco in 1978. There was a statewide, a nationwide convention of gay people in Germany, 8,000 gay people. We've never had anything like that here. There were letters written to the Reichstag to tell them to throw out the anti-gay laws. Scientists, doctors, everybody was preaching for gayness and acceptability. In Russia, 1917, they threw out the anti-gay laws. And then Stalin took over. And that was the end of the gay movement. Hitler took over, then the gay movement. And if you think history doesn't repeat itself, you're crazy. And the only defense about that is it's not just to be organized, but to get involved and to realize who the common enemy is.
You're listening to a conversation with the late Harvey Milk on This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine.
Unfortunately, within the gay community, we have such a class distinction and racism within the gay community and sexism within the gay community, because some people think they're better than the rest. When it comes down to it, we all do the same thing. And the elitists in the gay community, those who are accepted, those who are the Uncle Toms, those who have sold out, must realize that when the push comes to shove, that if Senator Briggs wins against the gay school teachers, the next thing he may say is, we don't want gay people to vote. And when my gay, elitist, wealthy brother or sister says, I don't have to worry, I don't get in trouble with the police, I don't go to the bars, I don't go to this, Okay, it's that old story in Germany. You know, first it was the gays and the gypsies and then the Jews, and it kept going. Finally, there was nobody to protest. You've got to stop them at the beginning. They've got to get involved. The gay elitists, the gay wealthy people, the gay society people, the gay people who have made it, they have to fight the battle now.
In many cases, they're in the better positions to be able to do it.
And they also are in a position to lose more. Because the gay street person, i.e., whatever that means, what does that person get to lose? By fighting the battle.
Well, that's why they were out in the front
right,
at the beginning.
Right. But the well-to-do, those who have made it, they've got a lot to lose. They've got to lose what they're worried about. And they're the ones who have to come through. And if they want to stay in their closet and so forth, fine, but get their checkbooks out of the closet. It's needed. It's desperately needed that the checkbooks come out of the closet. I know the power I have as elected official in this city. It's incredible. I mean, I'm restricted by the charter of what I can do or I can't do. But boy, can I do it. And I know that when I speak out in this city, I mean, the police department is nervous. The Chamber of Commerce is nervous. I know the power I have. And if you don't start, whoever's listening, if you don't start helping electing gay people, and not just gay people, but gay fighters who will get up and not take it and sit back, will fight for it. If you don't start electing it, we're going to be in trouble. Gay street people have to register and vote, and they have to realize that it cannot be only voting for the people who believe in every single thing they do. You know? There's no such thing. There's no such perfect candidate, you know. They have to compromise and bend to realize they... And the gay person who is living in the hills has to realize that he or she can't only support the conservative type people or the respectable type people. That you both have to lose. You both will lose. And if you don't get together, and you've got to join hands now, it's desperate. It's desperate.
We had a couple of gay people running in as candidates for assembly in Los Angeles, in the Los Angeles districts 44th and 46th. Some political gay political clubs did not endorse them. I'm not going to be critical. I don't want to get into that issue. But what I want to ask you is, what happens when you have two or three or four gay political groups or gay organizations that are in a position to help, but who cannot seem to get together? Because obviously, you've got to have a coalesced movement in order to elect somebody. What can you say to these people?
In my first three attempts to run, I run four times if I win, I was never supported by the gay establishment. I was never supported by the gay political leaders. I was never supported by the gay clubs. And the reason why is if I won, I would have been what I am now that I won. And they would no longer be the top of the hill. They don't realize that there's room at the top for a lot of people. They wanted to be, they'd rather have been the Uncle Tom in the back of the bus, or the Aunt Mary, as I call them, and be the token, be the first to discover Barbara Streisand, to be, you know, the token fag, rather than see a gay person elected and the power go that way. They didn't realize there's room for plenty. And I have found out in San Francisco, the so-called gay leaders of the time, the Jim Forsters and all those people, they were for themselves, they were not for the gay movement. That their attitude was so offensive that they would back straight people. I found that their influence was such that they brought Elaine Noble 3,000 miles cross country to campaign for a straight person against me, a gay person, both of whom she had never met. And even this year, Alice B. Toklas would never support me. Some of the other gay Democrats...
You're referring, for those who don't know, to the Alice B. Toklas Democratic Club,
right,
which is the version of the Stonewall Democratic
right.
Club in Los Angeles.
And some of the other Democratic clubs this time did. They finally realized what it was all about. And finally I was able to break. It took me four times to convince them. And the thing is that I've always done well, even though these people were knifing me, lying, smearing, and everything else about me. Because the people in the streets understood. The people in the battles understood. We got to admit. And so my answer is to L.A. is get it together. I find it offensive that gay leadership is so jealous of somebody else. I find that offensive. I find that people who say, oh, well, but we owe this to this person like that. I say, bull. You owe it. The reason is gay political clubs is to get the ultimate, is to get gays elected.
That's why it exists, because we've been set up. And then to walk away from gay candidates, unless they're unqualified, that's a different story. When I say unqualified, I mean when they're really ass. They're X-rated. Beep. If they no good, if they turkeys, that's a different story.
Well, if they're turkeys, they probably should never have gotten to the point where they're running in the
first. Well, no, turkeys can run. Anybody
that's
can
true.
Run.
Well, yeah, I've seen that.
Turkeys get elected.
God knows.
But when you're faced with a, even if you're faced with a gay turkey and a straight turkey, you know, if you go to the gay, and show me how many great non-gay candidates there really are. But to come up with the reasons that I read about, I just, well, I know that the gay candidates in L.A. were facing the same thing I did. My advice to them is that then work that much harder and throw out those so-called gay leaders who are not gay leaders, but they are self-perpetuating self-leaders, self-appointed, have never done anything to get broad-based support, elitist support, yes, or groups, yes, but
sounded
never
very much like David Goodstein, and yet I understand Goodstein did not support
you. Oh, Goodstein fought against me bitterly. Bitterly, for
and
the same reason.
And then threw a victory
well,
party
he,
for you.
He lost. You know, at least he's smart enough to realize who won. He lost. And he understands. Goodstein was always against me. Used everything he could against me. And he never met with me. Never understood what it was about. But if the gay establishment doesn't understand what the gay movement's all about, you gotta get rid of them. And I'm not telling you they're not nice guys. Not nice, wonderful people. I'm not talking about that they're fun people to be with. But if they don't understand what the gay movement's about, you gotta get rid of them. And I'll tell you what the gay movement's about. After I got elected, I got the phone call I knew I'd eventually get. Got caught a few of them. One was from a 17-year-old child in a small town in Minnesota. And the boy is handicapped. And the boy's parents found out he's gay, and they want to put him in an insane asylum. And that boy needs help. And the gay movement is about the letter I got from Southwest Africa when he read about a gay person getting elected here. And that person has hope. And that 17-year-old kid in Minnesota has hope. And we have gay leaders not understanding that and are more worried about their own personal power. They're not gay leaders. They're offensive.
Another reason that some people don't register or don't want to get involved in what they will call, quote, establishment politics is that they're just anti-establishment politics, period. You know, that the way to change the system is revolution, blah, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What can you say to these people who don't want to get involved, who don't want to register, who feel like voting and the whole establishment political process is a waste of time and not the way to do it?
Because the establishment political process stinks. I, too, would prefer to throw a bomb. Except the establishment has more bombs than I have. So the option is something that I told, about 3 years ago. 3 years ago, there were a group of three, or maybe it was 4 years ago, three of gay socialists came in who I know, and we had a nice long talk, and they talked about how bad the system was, and that the system has to be overthrown. Then we got talking about police brutality and harassment. And I said after a while, what if you were the three police commissioners, and I was the chief of police? And they said, great. I said, I thought the system stinks. It's not the system that stinks. It's the people who are running the system stinks. If everybody out there who thought the establishment and the system was rotten were running it, if the most radical liberal person, revolutionary person was the mayor of L.A., and the next one was the chief of police, and the next group of the city council, the next group of the board of supervisors, they would be able to change the system. You have two ways of changing the system, revolution or getting in and bending it from within. Unfortunately, revolution will not work. I mean, it ain't going to happen. As long as there's two cars in every garage and a little drop of gasoline and a TV set and you can wash your glasses and not get spots on it, the revolution is not going to exist because people are afraid of the unknown. And so they rather have the awful conditions that exist rather than the unknown. The revolution will not be televised. But rapid evolution can take place already on the Board of San Francisco Supervisors in 6 weeks. Things that were never discussed before have been discussed. The dialogue has been opened, which was never there before, and we won a lot of the votes. The very first major battle, and it doesn't sound like a major battle, but it is a major battle, was the location of a drug rehabilitation center, a Latino drug rehabilitation center in a white neighborhood. And the conservatives just won at it. And I battled them. I really battled them on it. And we won. We won the vote. A, that dialogue would never have taken under the old board. 7 weeks ago, that would never even come up for vote. And B, we won it.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Pam Marshall, Janet Mason, and J.D. Doyle, Chris Wilson, and Christopher David Trentham contributed program material. Thanks also to John Torres, Evelyn Ortiz, and John Frame. The late Michael Callen, with Chris Williamson and Holly Neer, performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is supported by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and by you. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to support our work, listen to our podcasts, read the text of this week's news wrap, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. Follow us on Twitter at TWO Radio. Read our blog at TWOpodcast.blogspot.com and check out our fan page at facebook.com/thiswayoutradio. To receive our weekly program content email alert, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on WLUW Chicago, Illinois, CKLU Sudbury, Ontario, KALW San Francisco, California, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Walensky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
I'm J.D. Doyle, and this is Queer Music Heritage, and I think this is the first time I've ever started the show with an instrumental. That was Harvey's theme by Danny Elfman, from the soundtrack for the 2008 movie Milk, and in a way, this entire show will be Harvey's theme, as I'm calling the show Harvey Milk Music. This is my gay pride show. And for it, my mission was to gather together music about and related to the Harvey Milk story. And when I began researching, I wondered if I would have enough material. Well, it's turned into a two-parter. And the music you're hearing in the background is also right on topic. It's from the 1984 film, The Times of Harvey Milk, with music by Mark Isham. If you are listening to this show, well, you probably do not need to be told his story. That he was the first openly gay man elected to public office in California to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, and that he served only 11 months before he and Mayor George Moscone were assassinated by Dan White on November 27, 1978. Milk quickly became an icon and a martyr for gay rights, and it seems his legend is only continuing to grow. In August of 2009, President Obama posthumously awarded him the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and California Governor Schwarzenegger designated his birthday, May 22nd, as Harvey Milk Day. As I write this in mid-May, I read about events planned for it not only in California, but beyond. But this show is not a history lesson. There are ample resources for that. But to my knowledge, no one has gathered together the musical impact of his life. He affected and continues to affect people on a personal level. So it's natural that a number of musicians and songwriters have been driven to create their own tributes. This is represented in many genres, including a musical and an opera, and I'm delighted to premiere during this hour a new song especially written for this show about Harvey Milk. This is definitely the first time a song has been written and recorded for Queer Music Heritage, so I'm very honored to share it with you. Stay tuned for that, but I'm starting off with a song from 1998 by Zoe Lewis. It's from her album Sheep, and the song is called Harvey.
What's his name? Harvey. I'd like to thank you, Harvey. This is to be played only in the event of my death by assassination. I fully realize that a person who stands for what I stand for, an activist, gay activist, becomes the target or the potential target for somebody who is insecure, terrified, afraid, or very disturbed themselves. Knowing that I could be assassinated at any moment or any time, I feel it's important that some people know my thoughts. I stood for more than just a candidate. I have never considered myself a candidate. I have always considered myself part of a movement, part of a candidacy. I wish I had time to explain everything I did. Almost everything was done in the eyes of the gay movement.
Over the end of the Zoe Lewis song, I faded in the last words of Harvey Milk, which he recorded in the event of his assassination, and I took that recording from the film, The Times of Harvey Milk. That film is stunning, and I much encourage you to watch it. I did so again while preparing this show, and even though I had seen it before, I'm not ashamed to admit I was moved to tears during the scenes showing the candlelight march to City Hall, the evening of the deaths. The city was stunned to an incredible silence. I think it was appropriate that the observance marked the first performance by the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus, which had just formed and had only had their first rehearsal less than a month earlier. For their own 25th anniversary concert, they sang one of the songs they did that night in 1978, Thou Lord Our Refuge. And I'll go from that to another singer on hand that night, Joan Baez, who contributed Amazing Grace. After Amazing Grace by Joan Baez, you heard a little of a much noisier version. What that clip lacks in sound quality, it makes up in history, as that again was the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus, this time from the 30th anniversary observance at City Hall in November of 2008. Two of my musical heroes are Romanowski and Phillips. During the 80s and early 90s, Ron Romanowski and Paul Phillips recorded 8 albums and over 100 songs that chronicled gay culture. They were kind of the soundtrack of our lives, and their political passion was often evident in their songs. Harvey Milk was mentioned in the second verse of the song, Homophobia.
There was a man who took a stand to try to shed some light. He said that sexual preference is a basic human right. The school board laid him off and said the budget was too tight. But it sounds suspiciously like homophobia to me. A woman with a child of 6 could find no place to live. And finally her lover said, why don't you just move in? The landlord made excuses and raised the rent again. Sounds suspiciously like homophobia to me. It happens every day. No matter what they say, it's just because you're gay. Homophobia. It happens everywhere. You know it's out of fear. It's just because you're queer. Homophobia. Some liberals say that it's okay for people to be queer, as long as they don't flaunt it. But it seems to me, my dear, that we've seen straight folks flaunt their sexuality for years. Sounds suspiciously like homophobia to me. There was a man who shot our first gay supervisor dead. The Twinkies made him do it, that's what his attorney said. He could have gotten life, but he got 7 years instead. Sounds suspiciously like homophobia to me. It happens left and right. That's why we must unite. We gotta stand and fight. That old homophobia.
I think I just heard the word homophobia for the first time. It, you know, it hasn't always been around. Somebody finally coined it, and it was, people were using it a lot, and I thought there was something kind of musical about it. Just like the sound of it. And that's where I came up with the homophobia. And that was the first song that Paul and I wrote together.
There's a song that went through many changes and rewrites, and we wrote new material for it all the time. When you're writing topical songs, the topics change quite frequently, so in order to keep current, you have to rewrite them. And it's fun to do that, actually.
And that was Ron and then Paul commenting briefly on their song, Homophobia. The song appeared on their 1986 album, Trouble in Paradise, and during the time period in which they were recording that album, Dan White committed suicide, which again brought home the lyrics for them. I mentioned that Harvey Milk is continuing to influence songwriters. An example is a young artist living in San Francisco, Neil Aaron. He was an extra in the movie Milk, and that helped inspire him.
Why did you write the song, Harvey?
Well, you know, I was very inspired by just, you know, living in San Francisco, and I'm on Castro Street every day. I probably walk by his old camera shop every day, and, you know, I've heard a lot about Harvey, and I read the Life and Times of Harvey Milk, the book, but it was when filming started that I really became very interested. The more I was starting to learn about him and the history of the gay civil rights movement and just him as a person, talking to his friends, and I just started really getting a feel for him. So it really started my singer-songwriter wheel turning.
Tell me about the song itself.
I like to write in a lot of metaphor and a lot of, you know, visual stuff. And with knowing the history, you know, I just kept researching and reenacting the scenes. You know, I was an extra on the film, watching it all go down and being, you know, dressed in the clothes and really made me feel like I was there. And so the song really comes from feeling like I relived it, but I didn't, kind of like here I am 30 years later and, you know, kind of reflective of what's changed, what's not changed, and, you know, that I still feel his presence with me.
There's one line in the song that I want to reference that I'm not sure people who don't know history would get. The shot that burst through the closet door, white knights were waging war.
Well, the burst through the closet door, he once had said in a speech, if a bullet should pass through his brain, let it burst through every closet door that's out there. And actually in his old camera shop, there's a mural of him and it's a gun and it has that quote coming out of the gun going towards his head. I felt like it was a very, very vivid wording that he had used, and I really liked it. And White Knight, where, you know, the White Knight riot, and I kind of play on the word knight because it, you know, like you think of knights dressed up in armor, you know, white knights, and then, you know, waging war, but at the same time it's the White Knight riot. You know, that was when the, you know, the verdict came in that it was manslaughter, you know, and there was a big riot downtown, and, you know, I got to reenact the riot too, and it was like, you know, having Cleve Jones there and Danny Nicoletta and having them tell their firsthand accounts of what that night was like, you know, it really puts you in that moment, and you know, you have all these burning things, and you're just like so angry, and it was just such a part of the story.
Castro Street, in the camera shop, at a meet and greet, hit the pavement, shaking hands, bring me your weary to take a stand, you're recruiting me, 30 years later, I'm still walking, I feel you here, at my side, Harvey just in case you're watching, I'm just about to hit my stride. On the stairs of City Hall, one step forward, then back we fall. Breaking trail, taking the lead. If at first you don't succeed, you're recruiting me. 30 years later, I'm still walking. I feel you here at my side. Harvey, just in case you're watching, I'm just about to hit my stride. Shot that burst through the closet door, white knights are waging war. After the candle we raise the torch, from the battlefield to your front porch. 30 years later, I'm still walking, I feel you here. In case you're watching, I'm just about to hit my stride.
The song Harvey by Neil Aaron. I told you earlier that there is a musical. It's called The Harvey Milk Show, written by Dan Pruitt and Patrick Hutchinson. And since its creation in 1991, it's been performed in many cities across the country. From the cast album from 1996 is the song, We the People.
We the people stand united for the rights
of everyone. Let the slightest not be slighted. No one's due must go undone. We the people shall proclaim it to the least of these our kin. These who love may dare to name it. These who dare are welcomed in. These the smaller, these the younger, these who crave a gentle breast, these whose hearts and bellies hunger, these who strive and find no rest. Mocked and taunted, these outside the rightful feast, these whose doors the wolves have haunted, these who daily face the beast, these the faceless, these unheeded, these who taste the bitter blade.
Come back to the musical, The Harvey Milk Show, later, but I also want to share with you a bit of the opera called Harvey Milk. This was a very ambitious and well-received work, and its world premiere was by the Houston Grand Opera in January of 1995. With music by Stuart Wallace and libretto by Michael Corey, it's also been performed all over the world, and the recording we have was by the San Francisco Opera in 1996. It is such a dynamic work that continually flows through the story that it was a bit hard for me to pick what to play for you and what would make sense out of context. But I went for the piece telling of his first campaign for office, where the character Anne Cronenberg tells of meeting Harvey and becoming his campaign manager.
I am Harvey Milk, and I
not selling Girl Scout cookies.
Well, that must have been a thrilling piece to see live. In that section called A Street Campaign, the main voices of Ann Cronenberg and Harvey Milk were by Jill Grove and Robert Orth. I've got a very political act for you now, as evidenced by their name, Queer Conscience. The gay agenda message that drove their music was their whole reason for forming. Their song about Harvey was from their 1993 CD, Back to the Other World. I interviewed the founding members for my March show and asked Rick Creswell about the song Harvey, the Ballad of Harvey Milk.
Well, it's a story that a lot of us know about, being one of the first out people in politics in San Francisco. And this is just kind of a tribute to him, and I was really happy to hear, this was maybe 10 years ago, that someone had been visiting San Francisco. It went into the public library, and they were having some kind of remembrance of Harvey Milk. And right on display was the lyrics to my song, which I thought was very cool.
Fighting the battle to free us and give us a voice. His challenge to discrimination was to offer us a choice. Determined to stretch social limits and to teach them all to see. A young boy's voice in a phone call said, thanks for helping me.
Hi, this is Rick Cresswell
and Jamie Pierce
of Queer Conscience, and you're listening to Queer Music Heritage.
And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. And this month, there's a part two to the show, which includes a number of songs about Dan White. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Friday night, Saturday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude. In my research for Harvey Milk-themed songs, I came upon several that incorporated Harvey's speeches into a song or simply just put music behind them, as is the case of this one by a group called CauseCast.
Somewhere in Des Moines or San Antonio, there's a young gay person who all of a sudden realizes that she or he is gay, knows that if the parents find out, they'll be tossed out of the house, the classmates will taunt the child, and the Anita Bryans and John Briggs are doing their bit on TV, and that child has several options: staying in a closet, suicide, and then one day that child might open a paper and says, homosexual elected in San Francisco, and there are two new options. The option is to go to California. Stay in San Antonio and fight. 2 days after I was elected, I got a phone call. The voice was quite young. It was from Altoona, Pennsylvania. And the person said, thanks. And you've got to let gay people know that that young child and the thousands and thousands like that child know that there's hope for a better world. There's hope for a better tomorrow. Without hope, the only gay that those blacks, the Asians, the disabled, the seniors, without hope, the essence give up. I know that you cannot live on hope alone, but without it, life is not worth living. And you, and you, and you, gotta give them hope.
You might call that Harvey Milk's Give 'Em Hope speech, and he used that message again and again in many speeches. This brings us to the world premiere I told you about, of a song written especially for this show. One of my artist friends who I much respect is Tim Kaine. He's an award-winning artist, and he was the founder of Chicago's first queer boy rock band called Boys Entrance. When I started working on this show in March, it occurred to me that, well, he's written so many political songs, he might have one about Harvey Milk. So I wrote and asked him that. He said he didn't, but he would write me one. And it happened, and I'm thrilled. He wrote it with Brett Allen Basil of the band Pink Sheep, and I got Tim to talk about the new song.
It's my sincere wish that Harvey's smiling today and that he continue to do so when the recording is finally unveiled on your show. He was actually the best man at my gay union in City Hall in San Francisco last year. I truly felt his presence that day. You know, it felt fated that my beloved Santos and I were brought to stand in front of him, our martyr. It was his bust at City Hall during our union ceremony, and that was one of the most profound days of my queer activist life. I hope I contributed in some small way to his legend, and remembering that legends continue because stories are told and retold. What's your feeling about the song?
I am honored. I'm very pleased. It's everything I wanted.
I was delighted that you invested me with that responsibility, and he was someone whom I wanted to honor, and for whatever reason, Boys Entrance has done a number of tributes to people from Freddie Mercury to Princess Diana and John Henry Damski and, you know, and Harry Hay, of course. So in one respect, I had been thinking about doing something for Harvey, but I kind of thought, well, maybe I've done too many of these death mask tributes. So I was really happy when you asked me to do it, and I was pleased with the lyric and the way it came out.
Again, I am very honored for this song to be written for this show. Tim Kaine and Boy's Entrance and Give 'Em Hope. I said I would get back to the musical, The Harvey Milk Show. Well, I've got something pretty rare from the show, something not released commercially. In fact, these next two recordings were done about 4 years before the cast recording was made. That show premiered in Atlanta, so it was only natural for that city's choruses to embrace it. GALA is the organization supporting the gay and lesbian choral movement, and they have festivals every few years. When the Atlanta choruses went to the GALA Festival in 1992 in Denver, they presented two songs from the musical. First, here's the Atlanta Gay Men's Chorus with a live version of the song you heard earlier, We the People. And then you'll hear the Atlanta Feminist Women's Chorus perform the show's closing song, Young Man.
The Atlanta Gay Men's Chorus is delighted to be here. This piece, We the People, closes the first act. It's at the point in the show where everyone believes that it'll happen, and that it can happen, and that it should happen. And this is the text of We the People.
September, a brand new musical based on the life of Harvey Milk premiered in Atlanta and set the town on its ear. This year, San Francisco's Theater on the Square will host the West Coast premiere of The Harvey Milk Show.
Harvey Milk was the first openly gay candidate ever to win election to public office in this country. Only 11 months after his election, he and the mayor of San Francisco were assassinated by a fellow city supervisor who served less than 5 years for the crime.
The Harvey Milk Show takes us back to the 70s, a dark and troubled decade, but a decade, too, of hope and promise.
At the end of the show, when the hope and promise of his election seem to have died along with Harvey himself, when Harvey's grieving lover is alone on stage, lost and drowning in his own anger, Harvey makes one last entrance to deliver one final challenge.
Harvey asks, "Is there anything about us, our life together, did any of it mean anything to you?"
His lover replies, "Why do you think I'm still so damn mad?"
"Good. Be mad. Because mad is energy. And energy is the power to say, this is not going to do. But then get up and do something.
I've got an internet friend who's a gay chorus expert, and I want to thank Greg Allen for providing me with those two tracks by the Atlanta Choruses. We're getting down to the end of part one of the show. On part two, I'm going to play for you many of the songs about Dan White in my collection. An observation is that for songs about Harvey Milk, they really did not start showing up for a number of years after his death. But for ones about Dan White, they were immediate, especially after the trial. I've got about a half a dozen just from 1979. My comment is that, as in the genre of protest songs, anger was a powerful motivator to songwriters. Of course, part two of the show can be found on my website at queermusicheritage.com. This is J.D. Doyle, and again, I thank you for joining me for this show. I've got a wonderful closing song, one that's become an anthem. And while it was not written lyrically about Harvey Milk, his death inspired it. You'll hear Holly Neer talk about it, and then she and Ronnie Gilbert sing it.
I wrote Singing for Our Lives after Harvey Milk and Mayor Moscone were assassinated in San Francisco. And I can remember it being sung at many events, but the thing that always moved me so was these people would put up their lighters, their candles, and there were people in the street singing this song, the first verse of which is "We are gay and lesbian people," were saying those names about themselves for the first time. They were being very brave and coming forward and trying to take the rage and the hurt of the city as a result of Harvey being killed, trying to take that anger and direct it toward the social change movement so that something could be built rather than something destroyed. So it's become kind of a peace anthem, a gay and lesbian anthem, and an anthem that allies and gay people can sing together. In fact, oftentimes in the concerts when I start to sing that song, people stand and take hands and sing it together as a real glue in their community, which is very moving to me.
Have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 9 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles, and J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage, which is produced in Houston. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Brian Levinka, Jennifer Renee, J.D. Doyle, Glenn Holt, Summer Iman, and Jack Valensky. For more information about tonight's program, including links to websites and organizations mentioned during the show, visit queervoices.org. And you can send email to jack at queervoices.org. Be sure to listen to KPFT every Sunday morning, starting at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston, a Pacifica Foundation station. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Picture yourself driving home listening to a great story or a song or a discussion.
Suddenly, you find yourself parked, but rather than turn the radio off, you stay in your car to hear what you're listening to the end.
That's called a driveway moment.
A driveway moment?
Yes, it's that moment that you just can't get out of the car because what you're hearing is just that good.
Then hey, what better place to support KPFT?
KPFT features music, news, and talk that is so compelling people will do anything to hear the end of it. If you're in your car right now and have your cell phone with you, as soon as you pull in, give a call to our membership department at 713-526-4000, extension 314.
Give me that number again.
713-526-4000, extension 314. Speak to our membership department and become a member.
Your pledge of support helps keep this valuable resource on the air. This is listener-sponsored.